Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Juvraj, and today I have with me a very special guest. Join me in welcoming Vikram Vaidyanathan, Managing Director of Matrix Partners India. Thank you so much, Vikram, for joining me. Very excited to be hosting you today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Great to hear that, Vikram. And I think what stands out about this conversation and your career is just the amazing time span you've spent and the amazing companies you've partnered with. So I want to dive deeper into so much of that vantage point. But before we get there, I'd like to start on a rather abstract note and understand from you what the velocity of decision-making in today's ecosystem means for you. Because we've all heard about, you know, the conjecture and the chatter around the speed of decision-making, the frenzy of capital, the overcapitalized ecosystem, whatnot. But before, like, without getting into all of that, considering the nature of venture partnerships, which can be very intricate, very long, very in-depth, how do you make decisions at scale and with speed? I'd love to know that from you on a more broader level.
So first, it's just a fantastic time to be a founder because it's the amount of capital now chasing founders is at an all-time high in India. And I think it's only going to get higher and deservedly so, given the quality of both founders and markets coming in. That does force us to make a lot of decisions in a short period of time.
Right.
And I think it forces you to be very thoughtful about where you spend time first, which is which sectors do you want to spend time in, which kind of founding teams do you want to spend time in, which stage do you want to spend time in. And the more thoughtful you are about where you spend your time, it's you get yourself into easier situations, where you have some edge in making those decisions faster than others. Right. The first is where you spend time. I think the second is what you do almost before the meeting, right? So the how much pre-work you do before you come into a meeting can actually decide how that meeting goes and how far along you get towards making a decision. So some of this is, do you have a thesis or not? And a lot of times when we don't have a thesis, we just don't spend time, especially if it's a high velocity situation, because you don't have any edge in making that decision at all.
Nice.
Second is to do almost everyone else in the ecosystem knows more about that particular opportunity than you do. And if you're in that mindset, that going into the room, you have some thesis, but people know more about the founders, people know more about the opportunity. So if you just talk to everybody in the ecosystem very quickly, right? Whether it's customers, whether it's references, people that, you know, these founders have worked with, whether it is experts and angels who have a very different lens of looking at the world. And if you talk to enough of those people beforehand coming in, you can actually improve the quality of discussion, know what question to ask, and therefore will elicit sort of the best response from the founders.
Right.
After that, I think it is about, actually often what we do, even at that point in time, you talk about venture partnerships, is to make sure which amongst all of us is best suited to make this decision. And so there is interest, there is, you know what my partner would like or what one of our deal leaders would like. So we pass the ball actively to someone who is sort of most predisposed to making a good decision as well as a yes decision on a particular deal. So figure out all the pre-work, figure out who's best suited to it, and then hopefully you have a better recipe for making a decision. The last thing that I would do is that we force polarization, right? You do have to make up your mind pretty early, right? Is this something that is exciting? And if it's not exciting right off the bat, then it's hard for you to get to a yes in a short period of time.
Right.
And are there deal breakers which will prevent you from saying yes? So if either of these two situations happen very early, you again make things easy for you, and you know, don't force yourself into a lot of maybe situations, which force you into tough decisions. Frankly, it forces you into non-decisions.
No, that's fair. And I think that's very interesting to hear. But, you know, the reason I also asked that question is because you've spoken about in the past how you need to really develop these relationships with founders, because fundamentally, that's what it also boils down to. And we've also heard of these nuances and comparisons that venture partnerships are like marriages, they last a decade, whatnot. So what I want to double click on is, how do you develop that sort of a relation with a founder in today's day and age? And how do you know it's going to be right for the long run, both for the founder and the partner or the venture investor in this case? That would be very fascinating to know.
So before, it's sort of like you had a long dating period. Now you have a speed dating period. Yeah. And so the question is, in that speed dating period, how do you optimize success for a long relationship slash marriage, right?
Yeah.
I think it is maybe 2-3 things that we do. And one is encourage the founders also to do a lot of references with our founder groups.
Okay.
And secondly, we do a lot of references on the founders, because people who have worked with them or know them will know more about them than we ever will in those you know, few hours that we are spending with them.
Right.
So getting that collective knowledge for them from our founders and for us from their sort of immediate ecosystem is one big thing. Mm-hmm. Second is to spend a lot of time in different situations. And whether it is, you know, hanging out, getting a coffee, getting a drink, sometimes doing an activity, going for a walk, sometimes in a very informal situation at either my house or their house, it gives you a whole person perspective about the founder. I've even heard VCs and, you know, especially in China and so on, where, again, the speed of decision making is crazy. They, you know, go for like, they go on trips, they go on massages, all sorts of things, right? So you figure out different contexts, which gets you a whole person perspective about them. And third, I wouldn't say force conflict type situations, but force situations which provoke a lot of thinking and which are sort of maybe some obtuse choices or choices that are contrary to their point of view and so on. Because then it tells you how these conversations are going to happen.
Right.
So I wouldn't pick a fight for the sake of picking a fight.
Yeah.
But you do want to figure out if there is a chance of conflict, which, by the way, 100% will happen along the journey.
Yeah.
How do they handle it? What is their basis for handling it? Is there a basis for handling ego? Is there a basis of handling that I want to be right? Is there a basis of handling people that I want to carry everyone along? Is the basis of handling what is the best answer? Is the basis of handling what gives you the most alpha on growth? It tells you a lot about how would they deal with a conflicting situation as well as sort of different choices.
No, I think, no, that's very, very thoughtful, Vikram. And I love that the two best answers, you know, like I've heard a couple of folks say that, you know, either do the airport test of if you're willing to spend time with the founder for like 6 hours, if your flight is unlocked, or if, you know, you spend time with like on a strategy session and, you know, that tells you. So people have their decodes, but I loved hearing that. That brings me to point 10, since we're at this, you come from a interesting background yourself and, you know, you spent some time, you come from an engineering background who turned into consultancy and then came to the venture world, right? Having been through such diverse experiences and also now having spent considerable time in the space, how has your style evolved over the years when it comes to venture investing? And maybe if you can decode for us, what is it that you look for when investing in companies? I think that'll be great for just more context overall.
So two parts of that question. One is a journey, and then the second is sort of what I look for and so on. You know, hindsight, all journeys seem like they were the perfect path to where you were, but it is never planned.
Yeah.
And I just think that a lot of the things that I did led to where I am today. So I started off life as an engineer, building products, and a lot of them were sort of core tech, engineering, embedded systems type products. Had a fantastic experience at a mid-stage startup based out of Jerusalem and with an India office, and then was employee one at a startup as well. So all of those experiences, when I think about them, it was because I was just very curious about the world of startups. And this is, you know, we're talking early 2000s. Yeah. So, there, you know, we didn't have that much in India, but there was stuff happening in the world. And so there was a very high degree of curiosity that I want to be part of some startup. And honestly, at that point of time, you know, whatever I was doing, it was because I wanted to start up for the sake of starting up, which is actually not a good reason to start up. And that's why some of those things didn't succeed. I sort of meandered into B school, primarily because I was good at exams and I got in. And then equally so meandered into McKinsey, because it seemed like a great place to start. And it was a fantastic place to start. And it gave me a great way of understanding ambiguous situations quickly, understanding people, especially founders and top management, and how they make decisions, being comfortable in boardrooms and so on. And finally, being able to learn anything new very quickly. But mm-hmm. I ran out of steam pretty quickly on consulting. And even in consulting, I started drifting back to, hey, what's happening in the startup world, digital ecosystem. I started writing reports about that, even though we didn't have clients who wanted to do it. And then I just realized I had to be part of the startup ecosystem mm-hmm. and ended up at Matrix. And I remember telling Avnish at that time that I'll stay 2-3 years. After that, I'm going to start up. Right? In all my arrogance, I was, you know, this VC is not for me. And mm-hmm. I'll discover what are the great ideas, and then I will start up. And I think I didn't discover what great ideas are, but I discovered what great founders are. And mm-hmm. there was a revelation that I would not be a great founder. Mm-hmm. And I would have been a reasonable founder. I could have actually built something reasonable. Mm-hmm. But the level of, I think, delusion, and I mean that in the most positive sense, that belief, mm-hmm. In yourself that you can impact a problem mm-hmm. and then being able to sell that vision to the exclusion of all objectivity to the world for 7-10 years, I didn't have. And it is truly a quality that the forces of nature in founders have. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have that. But I liked the breadth of problems. I had a healthy mix of being able to spot reward and an objectivity in making decisions, which I thought could make me a reasonable investor. And that journey sort of worked out for me today.
Nice. No, that's fantastic. There are a couple of crucial points you mentioned there, right? And when you talk about founders and define them the way you did, I also like to call venture as a sport of identifying outliers after all, right? And when we talk about outlier founder journeys, considering that you've partnered with some companies for almost like 5-7 years and even more sometimes, if you had to maybe, you know, lay down for us some, you know, really crucial traits of outlier founders who have evolved over the journey of a company, how would you like to, you know, express that?
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, no two founders are the same. Yeah. And it's strange, you know, I talked about this level of delusion and belief in mm-hmm. yourself.
Yeah.
I think it has to be coupled with intellectual honesty. It's a very, very potent mix that mm-hmm. you truly believe in yourself that you can change the world. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you have an intellectual honesty on this is where you need to grow. And the mm-hmm. best founders have that, hey, I need to grow in this dimension. Hey, my company needs to be able to deal with this changing environment. And mm-hmm. if you are able to couple these two, that's actually the great, great founders. The second is what differentiates founders from, I think, managers or leaders is their resourcefulness and being mm-hmm. able to generate resources out of thin air. You will yeah. see founders where you think that, you know, their back is against a wall, they're out of options, and they will essentially make the wall magically disappear, or they will figure out resources that help them jump over or get around a wall or something. Right. And being able to generate resources out of thin air is probably the next thing. And the third is everyone is a resource.
Mm-hmm.
And figuring out, even if you're not the best person to actually do this for their company, who is? Because somebody or the other has experienced this problem or has parts of the answer that they're looking for. So it might be a board member, it might be an investor, it might be another founder, it might be a hire that you're looking for. So they're always thinking about how do I get that person who knows the answer? And that's the third, I would say, big trait founders that I've seen in founders. I guess the last one, which is, you know, which I think everyone acknowledges, is the level of ambition that founders have is just unparalleled. And I think the ambition that lasts, right? There's lots of different ways of defining it. There's money, there's, you know, valuation, there's, you know, lots of sort of markers. But I think those motivators run out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And founders who sort of rediscover why they started the company, they start a company with pretty altruistic intention, which is to solve a problem that they experienced or to create this big impact in the world. And at some point of time, you know, there is the founder rat race, especially everybody, and they're, yeah. you know, they're in that they're in that motion, which is, you know, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? What's the next thing, right? Might be the next revenue milestone, next valuation milestone, all of those kind of things. And then at some point of time, they discover why they started or rediscover why they started the company, which is to change the world. That this is the world, how I found it. And this is how the world will be after I'm done with it. And once you rediscover that, then, you know, nothing stops them, because then they can just keep going forever, because that's something that they are defining for themselves versus the world defining it for them.
Wow, no, that's phenomenal. I think that's a very, very succinct explanation of, you know, what outlier founder traits can look like. And I love that. But since we're at this, I think the other aspect of what you spoke about was identifying rewards, right? And I think wins in venture, like there can be multiple definitions for it. And of course, there's a quantitative side to everything. But if you look at the qualitative aspects of it, right? As an investor, considering you are actively involved in a bunch of your companies, you're actually actively also scouting for the next big thing. How do you perhaps, you know, think of wins in venture and what defines it for you? I would love to know that.
See, venture investing is a fantastic way of life, right? And for me, I want to do this forever. I keep saying that I'll do it till I die, and I don't need anyone to pay me. I'd like to get paid right now, but at some point in time, no one needs to pay me to do this, because it's a role that forces you to keep learning, and you get to be part of these people's journeys, which are founders who are changing the world. So that's your role. Your role is to keep learning about something new, find these people who are going to change the world using that something new, and then you get to go on these amazing journeys from them, and then you get to repeat. So I just think it's a fantastic way to live, because it keeps you young, it forces you to keep learning, and you keep growing. And I think for me, the wins are exactly about that. You get to something early, either it's a space, it's an area that you sort of spotted, it's just something that you found interesting, and then you went deep in that area. And then it suddenly became really big. That's the satisfaction that you get in venture. And the more of those journeys, and that's how I define a win. Now, that leads to you making money for your LPs and your investors. And that's my job. But the win comes from being able to get to something early and seeing it grow. And that gives you energy to go back and do the same thing again. Now, what do you learn from your wins? I think first you learn, you just get confidence. It's a confidence and patience game. And you get the confidence that you have to go big. And unless you're going big, right, that you're investing aggressively early and then you're doubling down much faster on something that is working, that's what leads to wins, right? And you just get more confidence to do that. I think the second thing is that it gives you a sense of gut and being able to trust your gut more and more. And I forgot which investor I read. Maybe it was Carl Icahn, I'm now forgetting. And he's talking about his investment process and so on. And one of the curious things that he had said was, listen to your body when you're making a decision which is sort of on the margin. And he was talking about, you know, how he was getting a backache or a stomach upset or something repeatedly. And his body was telling him that this is causing him too much stress in then making that decision. Therefore, it's a bad decision. Now, I'm not Carl Icahn, but now you'd start trusting your gut a lot more in those moments on either walking away or leaning forward really hard on those decisions. And beyond a point, you don't second guess it. I think the last thing is, you talked about wins, but I think the losses teach you a lot more. Because by definition, as a venture investor, you're making more bad decisions than good decisions. So let's say I get involved with 100 situations in a year where there are 100 companies that you meet. You make maybe 15 to 20 yes decisions. Of those, 5 really take off. So you made sort of 5 good decisions out of 100, right? Where you made a good yes decision. But then you made 10 to 15 bad decisions where you said yes, but it should have actually been no. So that's part and parcel of making those decisions. But then out of the 100 that you passed, 15 to 20 were backed by some of your other VCs and partners and competitors. And five or six of them took off as well. So you made another five, six bad decisions. So by definition, you made like 20 bad decisions and five good decisions.
Yeah.
And being aware of the process that you followed to make those decisions and constantly refining that process is to me leads to more winners, where you're just constantly refining your process and being intellectually honest that something was different in my process. The hardest thing is actually to go and revisit your mindset when you were making that decision. And some of my poorest decisions have come because either I was too defensive that, you know, one investment, a new investment could disrupt a existing investment, or I was holding on to my point of view and thesis too hard while not exploring the founder's narrative or where the market was going. So being truly intellectually honest about your own mindset and what prevented you from making a good decision is the sort of the next sort of Zen level of investing.
No, that's fantastic. Again, what I'm hearing is pretty much, you know, the qualitative ends of the process and just like carefulness in terms of the entire step of how the things unfold and just being aware, self-aware. And I love that. I think that entire flow of thought was, you know, a testification to how interesting venture could get and how so many of us youngsters can also look at it. So wonderful hearing that, Vikram. Now at this point, you know, I'd love to shift gears and also maybe understand more about the Matrix culture. And this particularly stems from the fact that whenever I speak to founders, there's such a strong focus on culture, hiring, and building the organization. When we talk about venture, we usually hear about thesis, whatnot, right? But I'd love to understand from you that as you build and as the other leaders at Matrix build one of the primary institutional funds in the country, how do you think about laying the guardrails of what venture looks like 15 years from today? And how do you go about scaling your insights within the organization per se? I'd love to hear your bits there.
Sure. So what defines institutional investing versus individual investing? There are great individual investors, and then there are institutions that make collective good decisions and then stand the test of time.
Yeah.
I think what defines great institutional investors or the culture of an institutional investor is the process followed to make decisions, right? And I don't know if you've read Ray Dalio's book, right? And he says,
principles.
So when you look at the culture of an investment firm, it is how you make decisions and how you make decisions consistently. And does everyone understand how you make those decisions? And that's the core of any firm. And for us, I was thinking about, you know, a few things, and, you know, we've actually put that down in a pretty comprehensive document. The first would be founder centricity. And we've been pretty vocal about that, and we put it out there. What does that mean? It means that we follow founders' backgrounds, motivations a lot while making that process. We figure out how they have actually made an impact in the world, and does that help them make an impact in the area that they've sort of chosen? And third, you know, do they have these motivations that can stand the test of time? What is that true motivation? What makes them tick, which will stand the test of the time where they'll be able to make a huge impact in this particular area? So that's founder centricity. And it's hard to actually put into words, but if you ask most founders that have experienced a Matrix process, they will say, hey, this was run very differently, or the meeting was run very differently, which is a focus on understanding them.
Yeah.
The second is we are extremely outside in. We call it sort of living in the unknowns, and I'm happy to talk about that. But trying to make sure that you're figuring out, there are lots of unknowns. Some of them are known to others, and some of them are just unknown to everyone.
Yeah.
But living in those unknowns and understanding those questions, and then being truly outside in, where we are bringing sort of the best information, data, expertise to bear from the outside. Right? If you keep thinking from the inside and thinking inside out that we know what is happening, we are in such fast-moving market, there is no chance we know what is happening.
Yeah.
So you're trying to find references, you're finding consumers and customers who are seeing the world changing, you're finding these angels and founders who have a wonderful way of looking at the world that you will never have, and making sure that you're doing all of that in a very short period of time in what we call an outside-in process. And the last thing is strong views weekly held, which is you need to get to that yes or no. There's no middle ground. You either are investing or you're not investing.
Yeah.
And so you have to get to that strong view. But the best decisions have happened when you're able to change a yes into a no at the right point or no into a yes. Mm-hmm. And so you can't get wedded to your answer. And mm-hmm. so you need to also figure out, you can't be like a candle in the wind or a twig in the wind, which is just blowing from yes to no. But you need to know what will move you from a yes to a no or from a no to a yes. Mm-hmm. And so that's something we religiously practice, which is each of us is strong views, but weekly held, and we know what's going to change our answer. And we actually put down that this is what will change the answer. And then the work we do is to figure out if that answer should change or should not change. Now, all of this, I think, is sort of subsumed into the kind of people that we mm-hmm. that we have, because we need to find people who sort of buy into this. Mm-hmm. So we have, I would say, spiky angular profiles who either come with a deep expertise or, you know, they are forces of nature themselves, mm-hmm. Or they really want to do sort of early stage investing with a passion mm-hmm. that we haven't seen before, but they have something which differentiates them from others. And we're looking for that one spike. And we're looking for people also who will not, were not conformatory in their views and are looking at different angles. At one point in time, we were looking for a more commerce majors. We were looking for more arts and sciences guys to complement all of us who might be very engineering bottom up in our sort of thought process. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for high potential angular profiles, but people who really have the humility to go on a learning journey mm-hmm. and are willing to actually constantly put the microscope on themselves and then learn along the way, because that's what we need if they're going to become an institutional investor at Matrix.
Great. No, I think that again is great articulation in terms of the thought process, I think. And just this line of thought shows that this has been intricately thought out, and that's very refreshing to know. I think there are two pointers that I want to bring about. And this was from my conversation with Sarthak. Kudos to him for spending some time with me and the other founders who've been at Matrix and have spoken about it in various interviews. One thing I've realized is they talk about this entrepreneurial culture and execution first investors. And these both of these traits are, let's say, synonymous to founders, not as much for investors, with all due respect, of course. Help us understand as to, okay, being a part of the leadership of the fund, how do you transform and scale these two practices with perhaps anecdotes if possible? I think that would be a crucial piece to understand the entire circle of the culture at Matrix.
Yeah, so we do talk about it a lot, and we actually did an offsite earlier this year, and we talked about founders' mindset, mm-hmm. and we do think that is us. And I'd like to think it differentiates us, but I think there are enough people in the ecosystem who behave like that. But institutionally, mm-hmm. that's who we are, and that's who we want to preserve. And when we talk about founders' mindset, it is we expect our founders to behave in a certain way. And we just talked about that, right? Yeah. That they're highly resourceful. They generate choices out of thin air. They, once they have figured out a choice, then their execution intensity is amazing. And so we want to behave the way they would behave. And so often initially we would ask the question, what would Bhavish at Ola do in this situation? What would Ashish at Off Business do in this situation? What would Harshil do in this situation? So it's sort of, if they can do it, and if we are their closest partners and we want to be their closest partners, why can't we? And why can't we behave like that? Initially, some of it was in helping them and being their partners in their execution and so on. But then that translated into us, right? Our business. Mm-hmm. That we are, each of us are founders of our this firm, as well as our sectors. And so if one of our founders was running this, what would mm-hmm. they do? Would they actually take no for an answer? Would they be externalizing, hey, you know what, the other firm got to this early. Oh, you know what, I was on holiday. Oh, you know what, something else happened and prevented me from making a good decision. Oh, you know what, I didn't get access. Founders don't think like that. Founders are trying to figure out, okay, you know what, I made a mistake. Next time, what would I do differently? and I'm not going to take no for an answer. And I think that it's hard to explain, but once that becomes part of your vocabulary, it and each new person who's coming in is sort of adding to that practice, it just becomes part of the culture of the firm.
Great. No, that's amazing, Vikram, again. And I think that clarifies so much of how you're thinking about building an institutional fund for the country. And it's been amazing the kind of contribution Matrix has had in the past. As we go on to, you know, concluding the phases of this discussion, which has been wonderful, I'd love to pick on two abstract things again, the first of which being, let's say, a board seat, right? And now that you've been a part of some legendary boards, which are companies which have really broken through, help us understand what this inside view of a company gives you, and maybe also decode the vantage point that you have by defining what a good board member can add to a company and what the tenets of one might look like.
I think boards are important, but beyond a point, they're not at the early stages of a startup.
Right.
But the being a close partner to a founder, especially at the early stages, is what we strive to be. And I think I'm just going to repurpose what you're saying to that answer. I think your role as a close partner is two things. One is to generate new choices that the founder has not thought of. Because the founder is deep in the trenches and he or she is trying to deal with running this big organization and in a race against time and money.
Yeah.
And then they've come up with some choices. And often they will call you in the middle of the night and say, hey, there's a choice. What do you think you should do? Your job is not just to say, okay, think through those choices, but from your patterns of success and failure, generate new choices. Sort of live in the unknowns and think about some of the unknowns that founders at times don't think of and what can happen. And what is the possibility that something will happen? Right? Often founders think only in probabilities and not in that possibility and generate some of those new choices. That I would say is the primary role. I think at times you get into the mode of making that decision. And we are careful that we are not making that decision. Founders are making that decisions. They've taken a huge opportunity cost with their lives. And they deserve to make that decision.
Yeah.
Now, we might disagree with that decision. And that's the second role, which is how do you disagree without being disagreeable? And so we usually do it privately. We do it one-on-one. And sometimes if they are really wedded to a decision, we present a lot of data, which tells them what are the counterpoints to it. After that, they deserve to make the decision. And we have to go along with that journey. And then you just have to support it. You can't revisit that decision again. So I would say that's the first big thing. Generate choices and help them make good judgment. But then leave it to them to make that big choice. I think the second is to provide support and energy. I think founders have unbelievable reservoirs of internal energy to keep them going.
Yeah.
But sometimes even then, they need support energy from time to time. And I think that's where the magical partnerships happen. When you're there as a source of support. And it can be pretty lonely in those times. And are you there as a partner in those times? So I think that's what sort of early partnership is about.
Right.
As boards scale, I think the best run boards, and because I don't want to avoid your question, the best run boards are the ones which have enough differing points of view. They're not either completely contentious, where they're not able to figure out how to work together, or completely, either disinterested or just cheerleaders. But there are enough differing points of view. And each person is driving like one role within the board. Sometimes one person is driving M&A, finance, things like that. Some person is taking the lead on audit and compliance as you go towards an IPO. Sometimes people are actually playing a critical role in hiring. And I think one of the things that founders do, and I actually done a podcast with Rajinder on boards and board composition, which is still not out. Hopefully it should be out this week. But defining those roles for board members actually leads to the founders getting the best out of the board as well as sort of harmonious functioning.
Yeah, and that's again very comprehensive. But Vikram, one evident thing from your conversations in some of these Matrix Moments episodes or how founders refer to you has been the close relation you share with some of these folks, right? And this was something that was pointed out in my research as well, that you stay intricately involved and you're almost always there. What I'm trying to refer to there is, without the praise, is pretty much how do you develop and become that first point of connect, that first point of, let's say, touch at any given point, be it a good or a bad one? How do you do that and fill those shoes as a venture investor can be the guardrails to actually becoming a successful one? So if you have any secret sauces there that you can share with us, I think that'd be amazing.
I don't actually. If I decode it, I think it is maybe 2-3 things. One is authenticity. Just be authentic and be who you are. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times as investors, you're putting on a robe or putting on a face, which is not your true face, or the and founders see through it. So be authentic and just say this is who you are. And if you're genuinely curious about their business, as well as just want to be a humble but close partner on their journey, founders welcome it. And so if you're authentic about it, I think that founders just see it. The second is some level of reliability on being there in the moments that count, right? When there's a sign of trouble, and can immediately reach you, and you're spending inordinate amount of time then they'll call you again and again. They'll call you when they're in trouble, and you'll be the first port of call when there's a big success.
Yeah.
So, and I do tell founders, I'm working with founders where somebody else in the team has led a deal, but I'm actually available. I always tell them that there might be times where I don't respond to you on every WhatsApp, but just say trouble or just describe something is happening. Then I will drop what I'm doing and I'll call you. And you have to actually live up to that promise. Yeah. Where you're reliable when there's trouble.
Absolutely. Authenticity and walking the talk. I think that's what I'm hearing. And those are two amazing.
The last thing I would say is when you're generating choices, especially when, there are big decisions to happening, fundraisers, whether to sell the company, whether to make a hire and so on. If you can suspend your ego and your agenda, and really truly think for the founder, then it makes you want to call them again and again. That is not to say that we are just the founder's best friend and we'll just do whatever they want. And often I actually say, hey, this is what I want, but this might be what is best for you. And this is where some of it on the margin, I would love if you optimize for me and get me to this. And having that conversation openly versus having a passive aggressive agenda that, hey, this is what you want. And then you're trying to manipulate them. Again, founders see through it. So, I found the best conversation to say, hey, this is what I want. And this is what I need. But these are your choices. And this, I think, is the best choice. Now, because we're partners, I'd love for you to optimize something around this and get me here, right? And having that as an open conversation actually leads to the best relationship.
Absolutely. I can only imagine anything that shows. And yeah, honesty can go a really, really long way and stems from the point of authenticity as well. So love that, Vikram. I think, Vikram, this has been very, very interesting. And as we close down, I'd love to just pick on very quickly 2-3 questions, which are specifically on your investor persona. This is a set of questions that I ask to most folks on the show. And so for you, I think the first question there is on context switching. I mean, that's such a fundamental role of an investor. And one thing that I've noticed again is, okay, you've been able to go back and forth and go deep as well as go broad in multiple situations through this conversation as well. So if you had to give any bits as to how do you go from one sector to another, one company to another, one scenario to another, that would be great to hear.
I think the hardest part of being an investor is context switching every half an hour to every hour.
Yeah.
And one trick that I actually often employ is actually changing my room or changing my position. It almost, you sort of switch your context with your feet. It sort of forces you into a physical space. And you'll see that I actually do that. I haven't done that in this podcast, but I usually will walk around and it helps you. And I sometimes do it consciously. Go for a walk. Sometimes I'll ask for a walking meeting, you know, ask for a coffee and so on. So that's one. Second is to prepare the key questions. Often you're sort of dealing with, let's say, hey, how do I do, you know, runway management, you know, in a discussion. And then you're suddenly switching to, how do I actually figure out this growth engine for this company? And these are like completely different things. And often if you don't force that context switch, you will end up marrying these two discussions and both will be suboptimal. So figuring out what are the questions that you really want to answer going into it is probably the thing that helped me the most.
That's great. I think physically, like living up to context switching and then just being, you know, prepared for a situation is my cue from there. The second part of this is pretty much around staying ahead of the curve. So when you try to find these hidden gems and, you know, become a master at a subject that is unexplored, when you talk about the unknowns as well, it's easier said than done. So if you have any mental models around ensuring that, you know what you're talking about and staying ahead of the curve in a particular discipline, domain, have that thesis, how do you establish that? How do you enable that? That'd be great.
It's the reverse of what you said. I actually am in the mode of, I don't know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
And the more I am in the, hey, I know only 5-10% of something, the more I'm in listening mode and where, you know, somebody says something and you're like, oh, you know what? That's not something I know. Instead of saying, oh, I know something about it. And often you will see people say, oh, I know something about it. And you're trying to add to the discussion versus, hey, tell me more. And often it is in these conversations, you know, with founders, operators who are very deep in what they're doing and they suddenly say something. And at that point of time, if you're in the, I don't know enough, and you're, you just follow their narrative, then suddenly you're onto something. Now, even they might not know how big, you know, what they've said is, but if you follow their thought process, sometimes you can figure it out.
Awesome. No, that's great. I mean, doing the reverse and not knowing enough so that you can know eventually is my cue. Just listening and having that student's mindset, I think, just like learning on the go. That's a great cue for sure. The last one here is pretty much in terms of prioritization. I mean, again, all of these things follow the pattern of considering there's so much breadth in the venture business, especially for somebody who's handling things at a both micro level and a macro level. How do you prioritize the important ones? What are your mental models there? That'll be great.
So it's honestly more how do you manage your time through the day? Because if I just responded to everything that everyone threw at me, that's my day. And I don't know if I would actually be moving things along at all. So I start my day with, what do I want to get done today? Which is where I can make the most impact. And then I usually get to those very early in my day with the highest amount of energy. Sometimes before everyone wakes up, sometimes this pocket of time that no one knows and will be on the calendar and blocked. And so get to those very early, which is things I want to get done. Especially if it's something complex and it's going to take other people through the day to get stuff done, then I make sure that I put it on their plate to make sure it gets done. I think the second thing is, who are the most important people in my life? And sometimes it's founders, sometimes it's partners internally, sometimes it's partners externally. And do they need something big from me, right? Sometimes they might think it is big and important. It might not be, right? So you also have to put and then get to those. And then that becomes sort of prioritization. I think that same philosophy you have to, this is how I plan my day and plan my week. That same philosophy, if you apply to how you're planning your next 3-6 months, then, you know, you're able to get to big things early, you know, building out your team, helping build some part of your company's organization, thinking of one or two big business development or M&A events, all of that, if you start putting a longer timeline on it, you get to those choices.
Makes sense. I think what I've taken from there is just be more proactive as opposed to reactive in nature. And I think that can be so crucial. Often in times, you know, you get so stuck in executing, which is, of course, a trait that is necessary. Can't really look at the larger picture, but I can see you planning very well and talking about that proactiveness. This has been great, Vikram. And as we close down, I'd rather be stereotypical here, but, you know, we've spoken about a bunch of aspects, different places, different stuff. But if you had to summarize the most important, I wouldn't say learnings, but let's say the downfalls that you've had, the wins that you've had, if you had to just put it, buckle it up together and maybe, you know, talk to a Series A founder or let's say a seed stage founder via this podcast, if you had to summarize three of your learnings for them, what would you leave us with? I think that'd be a great concluding point.
So number one would be focus on the big, big things. Actually, let me step back. May that somewhat. Your role in your organization is to, sorry, I think I lost you there for a second.
No worries.
Your role in the organization is to provide the next boost, right? And figure out the next orbit. And I always equate the, I have this analogy that founding a startup is like sending a rocket ship to the moon, right? Mm-hmm. Lots of rockets usually don't take off the ground. So it needs a lot of preparation and a lot of serendipity to come together for it to get off. But once it goes off, then you need to fire the boosters at the right point for it to go to the next level of orbit. Otherwise, it'll just come crashing down. Mm-hmm. And as a founder and top team, your job is to discover that next booster. And sometimes it is hiring and figuring out the next 10, 15 hires. Sometimes it's actually getting them resources, which is money. Sometimes it is figuring out the best choices where you say, I'm going to focus on marketing versus I'm going to focus on ops. So figuring out at any point of time, what is the next booster for the next 2 weeks, for the next month is your role. And then after that, you have to focus 70, 80% of time on that one big thing. And I see the great founders, that's what they do. They actually don't do a lot. They just focus their entire energy on just that one activity, 70, 80% of the time. And then the 20% of the time they're managing. Right? They have to manage the org and do what the org needs them to do. But that founder energy is going towards that big thing and that big booster. So those would be the top two. The third is you're in a race against time and money.
Mm-hmm.
And taking sort of middle of the road decisions and managing lots of different variables at all times doesn't help you in that race. You actually have to make these polarizing decisions that, you know, I'm going to commit towards growth. I'm going to commit towards, you know, cash burn at different points in time. I want to commit towards hiring. You have to make these committal choices and you can't say, okay, you know what, I'm going to do parts of this and cobble it together. That sort of doesn't work at early stages.
And that's awesome to hear. And I think a wonderful, wonderful note. What I've observed throughout the conversation is a lot of clarity of thought and great articulation. And I think that's given at least me a lot of food for thought and hopefully everyone listening in. Thank you so much, Vikram, for your time. I think this has been such a pleasure. I hope you enjoyed it as well.
No, I enjoyed it a lot. And frankly, it was some of the most thought-provoking questions I've got in a while. And, you know, these questions sort of force clarity of thought as well. So thank you for doing all the research and hosting this.
Thank you so much, Vikram.